This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Hello, everybody. So I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to talk about some of the stuff that I do here and that I want to talk about today to you. So as a linguist, I do all sorts of linguistics things. Most people really have no idea what that actually is. So the polite seat neighbor in the airplane next to you who struck up a conversation with you, will usually start with some questions, often more or less skeptical. And one of the questions often, especially these days, centers around the question of, what is that good for? Especially because some people know that linguistics is often, like in many universities, part of the humanities. And so you regularly get questions in more or less politer forms, of course, like this. What is that good for? Who the heck needs that? Can't we just use AI for this, especially now, these kinds of things? And the usual response that you give if you're just coming from the humanities in general is sort of a relatively vague mess of things like, we teach analytical and critical thinking and we improve communication, cultural and ethical sensitivity, and all these kinds of things. And yeah, I mean, obviously, all those things are important to modern society. Who would deny that? At the same time, linguistics is, I think, interesting, and of course, I have a bias here, because it combines humanities and social sciences, and in fact, even STEM kind of fields in many different ways. So for instance, a lot of linguistic work by now involves experimental work, kind of like what you know from psychology or psycholinguistics, computational work, including simulation, a lot of statistical skills and stuff like that. So a lot of things that go beyond, the boring traditional humanities that many people look at. And so what I talk about today is the intersection of corpus linguistics on the one hand, and then forensics and legal interpretation on the other. So what is corpus linguistics? There was actually a huge debate in that field about what that actually is, whether it's a method or a theory. My answer is that it is a research method in linguistics based on corpora, and it's a research method that can be both sort of highly quantitative and statistical, but also one that can be very qualitative, close reading kind of work. And that, of course, just shifts the question to, okay, so what is a corpus? A corpus is essentially sort of a database, and it's a very diverse category of things, and it can probably be best defined by looking at, so what's the best, most prototypical example of a corpus? And a corpus is basically a database of language that was spoken or written or signed, and crucially, this is the most important point here, it's language that was used in authentic communicative settings. So it was language that wasn't produced to be collected in a corpus. It was used just like we use language every day in our speech and writing and whatever. And then it was collected for linguistic analysis with the idea to usually be representative for a certain linguistic target, which could be a complete language, it could be a dialect, it could be a register or a topic. And then ideally, the corpus would also be balanced for that target. So the idea basically that from like presidential election polling or something like this, the idea is that the sample of data that you're looking at is broadly representative of the language or the variety that it is supposed to represent. Same thing here. So maybe the best known example for such a corpus is the so-called British National Corpus. It was created to represent British English of the 1980s. It's about 100 million words in about 4,000 files. And it includes the language that was spoken and that was written, together with some additional annotation. Like for every word it says, is it a noun, is it a verb, is it an adjective, or something like this. And it also includes some demographic information about the speakers. Now, the first case study I want to talk about today involves a case of internet trolling. Or defamation. So what was the situation? So a lawyer approached me, and these were the facts, as he saw it, that he gave me. So his client, let's call him C, is running a restaurant. At one point in time, a specific person, a patron, went there for dinner. Ultimately, they got into a verbal altercation, and at the end of that, the client, the restaurant owner, kicked the patron out. Okay? And then shortly after that, what happened is that several extremely negative anonymous reviews of that restaurant surfaced on the internet, in particular on Yelp, which is a page that you probably all know, and then a page that I hope no one here knows, the rip-off report. If you've ever seen a cesspool on the internet, this one is it. So you can basically post anything about anyone there, completely uncensored, completely without responsibility. And that's, if you think what such a page might look like, make it twice as bad, and you got it. And then the second thing that happened is that the patron sued the restaurant owner for damages and compensation. And so what the lawyer asked me then is, can you show that that patron wrote these anonymous reviews on Yelp and the rip-off report? Okay, because the idea is, the lawyer was saying, you know, if you can show that, then I can argue that the patron wrote those with two goals, namely A, you know, to just portray the restaurant in a really bad light, which obviously would sort of be some payback, you know, influencing the restaurant's reputation and revenue. And then second, maybe to also support her own lawsuit, right? Because she would be going to the judge or the jury and say, look how bad they are. You know, they do this to other people too. Obviously, you got to give me my compensation, right? Those are really bad people. Now, if you are in such a situation, there's a variety of considerations you have to make. The first one is actually one that you may not think of first. And that is basically sort of ethics kinds of considerations. Because the lawyer or the law firm will always approach you with some version of this, you know, some version of, can you show that what we need to be true for our case is actually the case, right? So the lawyer said, can you show that the patron wrote those reviews, right? And so that means for you, before you start something like this, or before anyone starts something like this, you have to know who you want to be, because there's essentially two radically different options. One would be, you know, you're a subject matter expert, you're like, you're a linguist, and you get presented a data set or a linguistic question within your range of expertise, and you do research on it with an open mind, you know, regardless of what the result might be. You know, you go where the data go. The other option is this, which also exists. So you'd be what is called a hired gun. So you will use or abuse scientific research methods or methods that look like that to reach the desired result, also known as the one that the lawyer would like you to have. Okay, I'm not gonna, I mean, we can talk about this in the Q&A, you know, I'm not gonna take a bigger stance on this here, but it's something you need to know in advance because you will be put in situations where this is really important, right? You, as a linguistic expert, of course, you have opinions on things. Law firms might contact you coming from, for instance, the complete opposite end of the political spectrum that you want to be associated with or something, you know, so this is something you do need to think of before you take on any such job. Okay. Once you've settled that, then there's a variety of linguistic considerations, right? And so the biggest one is, okay, so if I want to do this, what do I need for such a linguistic research application? And the terminology is a little obscure. It comes from an older discipline, doesn't matter right now. The texts whose author one wants to determine, so in this case, the internet reviews, those are called texts Q. And so obviously you need those. And then secondly, you need what is called training material. Okay, and training material needs to be of two kinds. So one would be texts that were definitely written by the person who you suspect to also have written the texts Q, right? So we need something that the person wrote who we think wrote those bad internet reviews. And then we need texts that were definitely not written by that person. Those are, of course, easy to come by, right? And ideally, all those texts would be super comparable, you know, in terms of, you know, register, level of formality, maybe even topic, you know, all sorts of other things. So you want to hold constant as much as possible so that really the main difference that you find, hopefully, in the training material is between, you know, well, this person wrote this, anybody else wrote that. Now, an example from literary research where much of this work came from could be, you know, that in your granddad's attic, you find you know, a super old manuscript from the 18th century, and you think, oh my God, I think this famous author wrote that. How would one figure this out? Well, one would look for training material that contains material by the author that you think wrote this manuscript as well, but then also other people, right? But then what do you do with those texts? So that's where we need to decide on a range of linguistic features to look at and statistical methods to consider. So for this kind of work, a ton of linguistic different features, different linguistic features have been used. Like pretty much anything you can think of with regard to language, and probably more, has been used in some way. So here's a an incomplete overview of some of the things that have been dealt with. So lexical features basically is linguistic speak for, you know, things having to do with words. And so people, for instance, looked at the frequencies of especially function words in order to maybe figure out who wrote something, right? So function words would be prepositions, conjunctions, things like that. And the idea is that function words are pretty topic independent, right? I mean, with, the word with or the with of, you know, doesn't dictate a specific topic, so you kind of make the effect of topic go away. It cannot distort your results as much. Other people looked at frequencies of n-grams, where n-grams is just fancy talk for, well, bundles of more than two words, of two or more words, right? So, I mean, in spite of would be an n-gram that actually also happens to be a lexical unit. Then word lengths, so some people, unconsciously most of the time, of course, prefer to use longer words. Some people prefer to use shorter words. And then there's a variety of differently sophisticated statistical indices of how diverse the vocabulary is that that a writer or a speaker is using over a certain period of time, right? So someone might be extremely repetitive, always reusing the same words. Someone else might actually consciously take care to not do that, and so that person's vocabulary richness measures would be higher. Sublexical features are features below the level of the word. So people might look at the frequencies of letters or characters, and also their n-grams. Right, and we actually see that in today's AI work to some extent. Right, so in part this will reflect people's favorite words, right, because the words are made up of the letters or characters, but it will also go beyond that. So it can be interesting. Other orthographic features, including punctuation, might also be relevant in this kind of connection. Morphological features are also below the level of the word. They can have to do with words, but also with things like, you know, do people prefer to use, you know, English, Germanic kind of words? Do they use more often than other people words of Latin or Greek origin and stuff like that? And then finally, there's, finally on this list, there's features that have to do with the level of syntax. So the lengths, the average lengths of sentences and clauses, right? Some people like to have very long sentences. Some people keep them very short. Some people have intermediate things because they use semicolons that break longer things up, stuff like that. They might look at part of speech frequencies. You've probably all heard or at least considered this idea like, okay, I can use a lot of long and complex nouns for something, or I can use verbs, which sounds more active or something like that. So things like this are also characteristic or can be characteristic of an author's sort of fingerprint. And of course, any of these and all of these can be combined. And then once you have some such data for all the texts, so the text queue and also the two types of training material, then, you know, we typically use some sort of statistical methodology to identify things here. And so in this particular application, the texts queue were, of course, the anonymous internet postings. No big surprise there. What's more interesting and maybe surprising in this case is the training material. For the training material, remember, we need texts that were not written by the suspected author. Okay, and so to get those, I basically created a comparison corpus by looking for reviews of similar restaurants, similar in terms of ethnicity, for example. It was an ethnic restaurant, so I looked for reviews of restaurants of the same ethnicity in the same, actually, greater metropolitan area where that original restaurant was located. Okay, now the more interesting thing, hold on to your hats, at least I had to, was that, of course, I also needed a writing samples of the person who was the suspected author, the person accusing, being accused of being the anonymous writer and who sued the restaurant owner. And so I told that to the lawyer, and the lawyer was like, okay, yeah, we got that. You know, I kind of thought you were going to go with this, so I already got this. And so then what I got was, it was a bunch of PDFs of email correspondences between the patron who sued the restaurant and what I call here a confidant, but the tricky thing is the confidant was the plaintiff's psychotherapist. So if you think, you know, your medical stuff obviously is confidential and there's no way, no. If you get a subpoena from a judge, then all of that stuff is there for linguists to read, okay? So think carefully about what you write to your therapist, as opposed to what you may say to them, okay? Because it may end up in court. All right, so those were the data. And then for the linguistic features that I decided on was the relative frequencies of punctuation marks, in fact, specifically their usage patterns. So things like, you know, do people put zero or one or two spaces around dashes? Do they put an Oxford comma before the, you know, before the last and an enumeration? Right now, everybody is talking about how M dashes or N dashes or whatever reveal ChatGPT use and stuff like that. You know, so basically all sorts of punctuation mark patterns. Why? Well, their use is often nearly unconscious. People really, it's not something people think about. People think about, okay, what better word could I use? But they don't think about what other punctuation mark could I use, right? It's pretty much automatic. We can see that in motor routines. So if you look at people who hunt and peck type, as we call it in linguistics, you can see that they have established motor routines for some sequences of keys. And you can also see it in Word. Like a lot of people, if you look at the formatting characters, you know, there's often a space after the final period of a paragraph, meaning where there needn't be one. You know, but people, a lot of people at least, just have this automatism of like period space, you know, to go. So it's something that really, you know, it's not easily manipulable if you don't pay really close attention to it. And a lay writer who wanted to disguise their identity would probably, you know, focus on a lot of other things before they focus on, did I just use the space before the semicolon or not? Okay, statistically speaking then, I used a multifactorial predictive modeling technique that is called random forest. It's a simple but effective shallow machine learning method that is based on what I call decision trees. But it's a little fancier and much more powerful than that. So decision trees are basically, that's an algorithm that visualizes hierarchically nested decision rules. So it's basically looking at the data and suggesting sort of a certain characteristic of the data, you know, is this there or is that there? And in the data where this is there, you know, the next binary question and the next binary question. So you basically get a reverse tree like that that consists of a whole bunch of questions that the algorithm asks the data. I'm simplifying here a lot, of course, but and then that lead to predictions that the algorithm is trying to make. So for example, you know, here's a stupid example, but you know, whatever. If a text contains no instances of behavior, you know, spelt like this with a U, but it contains one or more instances of behavior spelt like that, then, you know, it's a good guess that the text is written in American English, whereas if it was the other way around, you know, it would be in British English, simply because this is one feature where the two varieties differ. Right, again, simple example, but you get the point. It's if-then rules like this. In this case, you know, one rule and another rule, and then, you know, a predicted outcome. And random forests make those things better by generating many different decision trees, but also adding two elements of randomizations to them. The data are only, or the algorithm is only fit on hundreds or thousands differently subsampled versions of the original data. And at every splitting point in those trees, you know, only a subset of the variables is actually allowed to be used. This has statistically desirable consequences that I'm going to skip here for now. And then all the 500,000, 10,000, whatever trees are amalgamated, are joined together in some way to make predictions. So what did I find? So I took this algorithm, I put it on the training material to work, and it was really good at identifying the patron's writing in terms of punctuation mark features. In fact, it was this good. So the accuracy of identifying the patron was nearly like 98%. So there were really strong and really predictive differences between how the patron in the restaurant wrote and how other people wrote about similar restaurants in the same area. And then that random forest was applied to the text queue, so to the internet postings, in a line-by-line fashion. And the forest was always asked, you know, give me the probability that this line was written by that patron. Okay? And then all 205 lines were attributed to that patron, not a single exception. And not a single predicted probability for this was the patron, not someone else, was below, you know, 56%. In fact, the average was nearly 97%. So the algorithm was, you know, as certain as an algorithm can get, in a way. So the punctuation strategies were extremely compatible with the writing of the patron, and it's extremely likely that she did indeed write those internet postings, right? It's not proof, right? It's not 100% proof. It's, you know, there's a certain probability of error that is involved here, but then it's up to a judge or a jury to decide, you know, whether this is, you know, beyond any reasonable doubt or not. That's not my job anymore. I provide these numbers, and then the fact finder in the legal context, that would be the judge or the jury, they need to work with those. Or, of course, try to undermine them with an opposing expert witness on the other side. All right, so the second case study is about the interpretation of laws and statutes, something that's becoming more and more interesting every year because of all the momentous Supreme Court decisions that are coming down every season, just like last week, for example. The example I want to talk about here today is Title VII of the Civil Rights Act from 1964, that prohibits discrimination because of, and then a variety of things, you know, like age, race, whatever, veteran status, and stuff like that. And then that sentence actually ends with, and because of sex. The question is, what does that mean? Specifically, the question was, in two cases before the Supreme Court that were merged, does protection against, for instance, getting fired because of your sex, does it protect gay people from being fired? And does it protect transgender people from being fired? Another famous example whose relevance will become clear in a moment is a famous legal hypothetical. Imagine a sign in a park that was put there also in the 1960s, you know, and it says no vehicles in the park. Again, the question is, what does that mean, for example, for someone who has a Segway, something that didn't exist when that sign was put up, when someone decided vehicles don't go in there? So what does that mean now? Can the Segway driver go in there or not? And of course, in this country, the most famous example, the Second Amendment. So the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Obviously, when this was written up, you know, the pivotal example of an arm would be a musket that needs a minute to reload. By now we have these things. So does that still apply? Right? And I'm not saying what's the right or wrong answer here. You know, I'm just saying, you know, we need to consider this. And basically what it points our attention to is that there are different kinds of dynamism in language and society. One is what in one study we call societal dynamism, and that is, you know, society changes because suddenly objects that didn't exist now do exist, or their definition changes. Second, the meaning of a term might change. And third, normative dynamism, the way we look at things as a society may change. So with regard to transgender then, one question one might ask in this context as a linguist is, how was the word gender used in the 1960s? And so we looked at 28 million words from the 1960s that cover a wide range of topics, registers, genres, and so on for gender. We found 102 examples, 84 of which didn't matter because they meant other things, and then left 18 that do matter. One of them was from Time magazine, one of them actually was on legal discourse, and then 16 of those 18 were from this avant-garde novel about genderless aliens visiting Earth. So, in terms of frequency, gender is really rare in American English in the 60s. Now you might say, yeah, okay, so 16 times out of 28 million, that means nothing to me. You know, how does that make that rare? One way to look at this is, well, what other words have the same frequency? And that would be those. And I think we can all agree that, you know, you probably know many of them. Even I, as a non-native speaker, know many of them. But, you know, I think we can all agree that they're not exactly frequent, right? But is frequency enough to make the case? And obviously, if I ask the question like that, the answer is no, because they are too imprecise. They're too volatile. They do not indicate how widespread a word is used in a language over some time. A word can be very evenly distributed in a corpus or database, or very unevenly. Words can have the same frequency and still be completely different in how they are used. Here's one example. The words enormous and staining that you see here, in the same corpus, that's a million words of 1960s American English in 500 different speech situations. They have the same frequency, the exact same frequency, 37. In a million, but enormous puts those 37 frequency items into 36 different files. The ones for staining are all in one and the same file. So obviously the frequency is the same, just as obviously that doesn't mean much. How do we measure this? Well, just to say, you know, linguistics can be highly statistical. Here's a variety of options that I will not bore you with now for the rest of the talk, just to show, you know, there's a lot of discussion about how one can do this. And If one looks at the dispersion of gender in 1960s American English, again, you can compute a certain value. The critical point is gender is as dispersed as these words. These are 26 words, one beginning with each letter of the alphabet. The critical thing you need to realize is the blue ones in particular, because I don't know whether you can already guess what this is. Those are OCR errors. So gender was as evenly dispersed as typos and OCR errors in American English in the 60s. Okay, so it's pretty much a non-word. But that leads to the next question. If gender was that rare and non-widespread, then how did people talk about that concept back then? What words did they use, you know, at case time? Well, they used the word sex, turns out. Okay, so we can see that in some very easy parallelisms. So here's two examples of how gender was used in the 60s and how sex was used in the 60s. So, you know, there can be war or animosity or enmity between the genders here, between the sexes there. something of character or moral standards can be mixed with gender or combined with sex. So clearly, you know, there's some parallelism there that suggests at least that these two items are at least similar, if not identical at the time. And we can also see that what is expressed as gender today was in the 60s expressed with the word psychosexual. So a 1961 textbook, for example, says this, although sex role identification has been discussed in part in the section, you know, in the book, dealing with psychosexual adjustment, blah, blah, blah. And then it even goes on, you know, it will be given fuller treatment in this section dealing with identity. I mean, we would talk about this today in terms of gender identity, right? That's the vocabulary that is current for this. Back then, it was psycho and then sexual. Similarly, what is transgender today in the 60s was actually still transsexual. That's how people talked about it then. True transsexuals feel they belong to the other sex, from one reference work back then. And even before that, even before the 60s, there were such examples. So for example, here from an academic article in sociology, from the American Journal of Sociology, a study of women college seniors shows that they commonly face mutually exclusive expectations of their adult sex roles. So the results of the analysis show, both statistically and qualitatively, that, you know, if you write because of sex in the 60s, today it means something about gender, for example. So transgender and gay people should be protected by Title VII. So corpus linguistics can help explore, you know, these kinds of temporal changes that I called dynamicity before. Here, in one way, this would be linguistic dynamism. So the meaning of sex in the 60s was this big, and then as gender grew, you know, it basically took over some of the things that sex meant, and that became smaller in meaning. The other way would be normative dynamism. So one of my co-authors on this is probably the leading law professor on constitutional interpretation and gay rights in the US. So he found law texts from the 60s, where gay people were discussed with this kind of terminology. Okay, that's not the case anymore, right? So society has changed and the way we look at things has changed. So wrapping up. So not all of humanity is completely useless with poor job prospects, lacks real world application, it's just ivory tower stuff. Even if it's only a discipline, you know, linguistics has a lot to offer. Yes, you learn about linguistic structure and use. Yes, you know about linguistic meaning and historical, social, and other kind of contexts. But you also learn, for instance, aspects of data science, programming, statistics, machine learning, all these kinds of things. Plus, once you go down that route, obviously, you know, empirically based reasoning, argumentation, and so on. So give it a shot. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.